Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to tonight's event. It's just a great, great pleasure to welcome our friend and beloved author, Isabel Allende, back to Seattle. We first thank Elliott Bay Book Company, our co-presenters for the evening. We thank the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs. Our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis. And finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Okay, I'm going to turn things over now to Karen Maeda Allman from Elliott Bay Book Company to introduce our special guest.
Good evening, and thank you so much for coming out to see Isabel Allende.
Thank you so much. I mean, this is incredible. I just read a story by Nathan Englander called The Reader, and it is the story. I made photocopies, and I have them all over my house. It is the story of a best-selling author 10 years later who goes from town to town in his little car all by himself. Nobody shows up at the readings except one reader who sits, the same reader who follows him in his car from town to town. They end up here in Seattle. You have to read the story because it's heartbreaking, and I know that that's my future. So thank you. Thank you for being here tonight. Thank you. Let me tell you a little bit about this book. And this sexy voice is because I have a cold. I wish I could keep it. I wrote Maya's Notebook in 2010. And the story happens in 2009. At the time, it was very contemporary. But the translation into English took so long that it is now a historical novel. It's already out in many other languages. So, and I have already written two other books since this one. I had to reread the book to know what the book was about because I had completely forgotten the whole thing. I had been writing historical novels for a while, and the last one was Island Beneath the Sea, the story of the slave revolt in Haiti. It took me 4 years of research. I ended up fed up with the research. And the last thing I wanted was to continue researching and studying these scholarly books that were boring. Nobody reads them. So I wanted something more contemporary and fun to write and something that would not require all that research. At the time, in 2010, I was surrounded by teenagers because all my grandchildren were teenagers. Can you imagine the energy in the house? It was just awful. And they had all their friends with them. Especially one of my grandchildren, they would get in trouble, stupid trouble. For example, my youngest granddaughter had the boyfriend from hell. And my poor son lost all his hair following this girl around with a GPS. And the other kids had other problems. In any case, thank God, they are all now in college safe. But for at least 2 or 3 years, we lived in panic mode with the kids. So naturally, the book I was going to write was going to be about what we were living in the house, the teenagers. And I came up with the idea of writing about a teenager that was uninvented. She's fictional, but she summarizes the energy of all these kids around me. So Maya Vidal is the name of the protagonist. She's a 19-year-old girl from Berkeley who is... At 16, she's a nice kid. She's athletic. She has good grades. She's a nice kid. She's been raised by her grandparents, a grandmother that is like me, modeled after me, so she's great. She's an absolute... She's the best character in the book. And then she has a grandfather who is an African-American step-grandfather because he's the second husband of this Chilean immigrant who is the grandmother. A short Chilean immigrant is the grandmother. And She adores the grandfather, absolutely adores him, and is terrified of the grandmother most of the time. And then the grandfather dies of pancreatic cancer when she's 16. And her whole world collapses. She feels abandoned because she really doesn't have parents. She has only her grandparents. The grandmother falls in a depression. The grandfather is not there. And she starts getting involved with the wrong friends in high school. Shoplifting, alcohol, drugs, petty theft, that kind of stuff. And that starts to increase and get worse until eventually she runs away from home. And then she starts this spiral journey into hell, into the hell of addiction, of the streets, homelessness, and everything that can happen, all the risks that I was terrified that my grandchildren would confront. For the research, I didn't have to do much because unfortunately, my three stepchildren are addicted. Two of them have already died of drug-related causes. One of them died 4 weeks ago. And so we've lived in the family, not directly with my children, but with my stepchildren. The horror of drugs and how that affects the person, but everybody around them as well. Everything, there's no way that you can help. The feeling of impotence, that you cannot help them at all. And so I had all that. The only research was to get out in the street and find out what were the new drugs available, because that changes all the time. And in the story, when the girl is really in the streets, she's dying, she's really very ill, finally the grandmother finds her, rescues her, and sends her to the southern part of Chile, an island called Chiloé. Chiloé is an archipelago of several islands, hundreds of islands, and some of them are very remote and almost not connected to the continent when there is a storm or in winter. It's a very harsh winter. And so the grandmother sends her there because the girl is persecuted by the FBI, the CIA, the police, the gangsters, the drug dealers. Everybody's after her. She got in terrible trouble without even knowing what she was doing. And so she ends up there, and there she cannot be connected with anybody because the instructions are you cannot get in the internet. Nobody can know where you are. And so for the first time in her 19 years, she doesn't have a cellular phone. She can't Twitter. She can't get in the internet. She has no Facebook. And she has time and space and silence to reflect, to start writing a journal and in a notebook, and to look at herself, look at what has happened in her life, analyze what has happened, and get out of herself and live in a small community of people who are very generous and they embrace her. But the rules of the game are that you have to give back as much as you take. And this is something that in those remote rural or fishermen communities, it's very important. People cannot be takers. There's a law of reciprocity in which things go like in a chain. You give to this person and this person gives the equivalent to another person and so forth. And Maya learns that she has to give back. And this is something that has always bothered me about the American society where my grandchildren are growing. That first of all, there is no extended family. So there's no sense of several generations living under the same roof, a sense of community. Unless you have a very strong religious feeling and you belong to a church, there's very little community. And then kids grow up with the idea that they are the kings and queens of the world and they are there to receive. And they don't have to give anything back, not even gratitude, nothing. That bothers me about my grandchildren today. So I keep fighting with them about that. They pay no attention. But I'm sure that sooner or later in life they will have to learn the law of reciprocity, which Maya learns very quickly in the island. And in the island she finds, first the person who receives her, who is a strange hermit, a strange old man, who lives in a house with no doors. She doesn't know why this guy received her. Why would he receive a girl, a conflicted teenager, American teenager, in his house? Then there's a mystery there related to the past of her family. And then she starts uncovering the secrets of this man. And the secrets are the secrets of the country. So the history of Chile, of what happened in Chile during the time of the dictatorship, that many people don't want to talk about, start to reveal themselves to her. And she discovers a lot of stuff that she never expected to find. So that's more or less the story. Now, will she be found by her enemies? You have to read the book. So I'm going to read a part that this is when she's in Las Vegas. The worst part of a journey to hell happens in Las Vegas for a reason that you may guess. I did research Las Vegas, by the way. So she has been, now she's homeless. She ran away from these drug dealers and she's doing prostitution, drugs, alcohol. She's homeless. She's very sick. The same day of my encounter with Officer Arana, a couple of hours later, Joe Martin and Chino finally caught up with me. I didn't see the frightful black van and I didn't sense the thugs approaching until they were right on top of me because I'd spent the $10 Arana gave me on drugs and I was high. They forced me into the vehicle while I screamed and kicked in desperation. Some people stopped, but no one interceded. Who's going to mess with two dangerous-looking bullies and a hysterical homeless girl? I tried to jump out of the van while it was moving, but Joe Martin paralyzed me with a punch in the neck. They took me back to the building I knew all too well, Brandon Lima's den of drug addicts and criminals. The rude things stored on the wall, the garbage and broken glass had multiplied, and it smelled of excrement. They dragged me up to the apartment on the third floor. "Now you're going to sing, you slut," Joe Martin threatened me, an inch from my face, squeezing my breast with his ape-like hands. "You are going to tell us where Lehman hid the money, or I'll break every bone in your body one at a time." At that instant, Chino's cell phone rang. He talked for a couple of seconds and then told Joe Martin that they had orders to get going. They were waiting for them. They gagged me with a rag in my mouth and adhesive tape, threw me down on one of the mattresses, tied my ankles together and my wrists with an electric cord, and then tied them to each other so I was bent backwards. They left after warning me again what they would do to me when they would get back. And I was left alone, unable to scream or move, the cord cutting into my ankles and wrists, my neck sore where they'd hit me, suffocating from the rag in my mouth, terrified at what was going to happen to me at the hands of those murderers, and because the effects of the alcohol and drugs was beginning to wear off. I tried not to vomit, though I was gagging and could feel it coming up my throat. I thought I would die of asphyxiation. How long was I on that mattress? It's impossible to know with any certainty, but it felt to me like several days, although it could have been less than an hour. Very soon, I began to tremble violently and to bite the rag, now soaked with saliva. With every shudder, the wire dug deeper into my skin. The fear and the pain kept me from thinking. I was running out of air, and I started to pray for Joe Martin and Chino to return so I could tell them everything I knew, take them to Viti to see if they could shoot those locks off, and if they then shot me in the head, that would at least be preferable to being tortured to death like an animal. I didn't care about the damn money. Now, months later, in this little island of Chiloé, with a calm of distance, I understand that was their way of making me confess. They didn't have to break my bones. The torment of withdrawal was enough. Outside, the sun had set, no light filtering between the boards over the windows, and inside the darkness was total. Meanwhile, I, sicker and sicker, kept praying the murderers would come back. But it wasn't Joe Martin or Chino who turned on the light and leaned over me. It was Freddy, my little friend, so skinny and demented that for a moment I didn't recognize him. "Shit, girl, fuck, fuck," he was mumbling as he tried to get the gag off my mouth with a trembling hand. He finally got the rug out, and I could take an immense breath and fill my lungs up with air, retching and coughing. Freddy, Freddy, sweet Freddy. He couldn't get me untied. He only had one hand and was missing two fingers of the other one. He never recovered the use of it entirely after that beating. He went to get a knife from the kitchen and started fighting with the electric cord until he managed to cut it and, after eternal minutes, free me. My ankles and wrists were bleeding, but I didn't notice until later. In those moments, I was overcome by the anguish of withdrawal. Finding my next hit was the only thing that mattered to me. It was useless to try to stand up. I was shaken by convulsive spasms with no control over my extremities. "You have to get out of here," the boy was repeating like a litany. Freddy went to the kitchen again and came back with a pipe, a blowtorch, and a handful of crack. He lit it and put it in my mouth. I inhaled deeply, and that gave me back a bit of strength. "How are we going to get out of here, Freddy?" I murmured. My teeth were chattering. "Walking is the only way. Stand up, girl," he answered. And we walked out the simplest way through the front door. We slipped down the stairs in the darkness, glued to the wall, him holding me up by the waist, me leaning on his shoulders. He was so small, but his brave heart more than made up for his fragility. We walked a few blocks in the shadow of the houses, getting away from the building. Freddy tried to stop several taxis, but when they saw us, they didn't stop. We must have been a deplorable spectacle. He took me to a bus stop, and we got on the first one that came without noticing where it was going or paying any attention to the expressions of repugnance on the faces of the passengers or the driver's glances in the rearview mirror. I was disheveled, smelled of piss, had smears of blood on my arms and shoes. We got out at the last stop, where Freddy took me to a public washroom, and I cleaned myself as best I could, which wasn't much. And then we got on another bus, and then another, and we went around and around Vegas for hours to shake the thugs off. At last, Freddy took me to a black neighborhood where I had never been. The badly lit streets were empty at this time of the night, lined with humble working class houses, porches with wicker chairs, yards full of junk and old cars. After that terrible beating that Freddy had taken for going into a neighborhood he didn't belong in, it took a lot of courage to take me there. But he didn't seem worried, as if he had walked down these streets many times. We arrived at a house not different from all the rest, and Freddy rang the bell several times insistently. Finally, we heard a thundering voice, "Who's got the nerve to bother us so late?" The porch light came on, the door opened a few inches, and an eye inspected us. "Praise the Lord, is that you, Freddy?" It was Olympia Pettiford in a plush pink bathrobe, the nurse who had taken care of Freddy in the hospital when he got beaten up, the gentle giant, the Madonna of the defenseless, the splendid woman who ran her own church of the widows for Jesus. Olympia opened her door wide and hugged me in her African goddess's embrace. "Poor girl, poor little girl." She carried me to the sofa in her living room and laid me down there with the tenderness of a mother with a newborn baby. That's it.
So you write in Spanish and then you get translated to English. How do you think the Spanish literature is going in the U.S. if the population is wanting to read more in Spanish or in English, thinking about, say, Hispanic people?
Yeah. I've been here for 25 years in this country. I wasn't planning to come, and I wasn't planning to stay, but I met a guy. And this is what always happens. You meet a guy, you fall in lust, and then you're screwed. And so I've been here for 25 years, and I have seen the change in these 25 years. When I came, there was maybe the same number of Latino immigrants in the United States, but they were not so visible. Now they have political power, they have a voice, they have a presence. The language has enormous importance. It's the second language in the country. And I see that there are two, three, four generations of educated Hispanics who read in English. They have forgotten their language, unfortunately, or they can speak it at home, but they cannot read it. So many of them are reading my books in English, but my books are also published in Spanish here in the United States, usually before the English translation, and they are pretty popular. So I'm pleased with that, and the translation I think improves my books, because I write the book in Spanish, and then it goes to my agent, and then it gets translated in Europe, and then it's gone. I can't do anything with the book. But then I get the translation in English, and I can see all the mistakes, because there is, you know, the distance, the filter of language, which it's like reading another text. And I read and say, why did I do this? I forgot that. Or then I find things that I could improve, and I sometimes do it in English. So it's not bad to read in English.
I was just wondering, do you have favorites amongst your books?
And favorites of my books?
Of your own books. And if you have one, why? Which ones are your favorites?
I don't even like my books. I've written like 20 books. I write all the time. I forget them. I truly do, because the characters become so vivid, so real. It's like people in my house, and they walk from one book to the other. I get confused. I don't know who was in which book and why. So it's very confusing. And I don't have a book that I prefer. I know that the readers prefer certain books, or there are certain books that have more impact on the reader, even if they don't like them so much. For example, the book that I get more letters from is Paula. I get more letters from my memoirs than from my fiction. And I spend so much more energy in the fiction. So you never know. The effort doesn't always reflect on how the book is accepted or the quality of the book. I hope some men will get up too, not only ladies.
Isabel, un placer tenerla aquí en
Sierra. Gracias.
I was reading your memoirs, and it came to me that did you use or you got inspired with Jennifer, the daughter of your husband, and the memoirs of Paula, because Paula was writing a biography and Ernesto gave you the letters. Did you mix both of your daughters to inspire you for this book?
My daughter was a separate thing for me, because she died. She had a condition that should not have been fatal. There was negligence in the hospital. And Paula ended up in a vegetative state. We took care of her at home for a year until she died in my arms. And Paula was 28 years old. She had a life in front of her. She was recently married. She was a happy kid. So it was a very painful moment. The death of my stepdaughter, Jennifer, was very different because she had been an addict since she was 14 or 13 years old. By the time she died, exactly the same age as my daughter, 28 years old. By the time she died, she looked 60. And her life had been shattered by drugs and by a lifestyle that destroyed her body, her mind, her soul, everything. So it was very different. When I wrote this book, I drew a lot of the information about addiction, not so much from Jennifer, because with her, I didn't have real contact. I only saw her either in jail or in hospitals. I never could establish a relationship with her. But my youngest stepson, I met him when he was 10. And he was a messed up kid at 10. And then by age 13, the whole situation was uncontrollable. But I did have a relationship with him. And when I wrote The Sum of Our Days, a memoir that followed Paula 10 years later, I talked about the family, about all the people that were around me. It's a memoir about my tribe more than about myself. And, of course, my stepson Harley was in the book. When I had the book translated into English, I showed the manuscript to all the people who were in the book, mentioned in the book, and I asked permission, their permission to be in the book. And Harley got really mad and said, I don't want to be depicted as an addict. so he didn't want to be in the book, and I had to rewrite the whole book and take out 50 pages. I was really mad at him, but I understand. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to be depicted as an addict and be forever in a book with under that label. So I took him out, and in my rage, I destroyed the pages. Never do that. If you're a writer, everything can be recycled. Don't throw it away. I threw everything away. Years later, when I was writing this book, I needed the 50 pages that I had from Harley, but I had destroyed them. But I did remember many things. I remember the whole process, and much of that is in Maya, in this book. Especially one scene that Harley told me that to me is like a key to understand the book. Harley told me that one day he almost overdosed with heroin in a public bathroom. Filthy, filthy public bathroom. And the door did not reach the floor. It was like, you know, the doors that leave a space under and a space up there. And he was lying in this filthy floor, dying. And he heard the voice of his sister, who was already dead, Jennifer, calling him, "Harley, breathe, breathe, Harley." And he saw her shoes under the door. And he started breathing. When he told me that story, I totally believed that he saw his sister. And so in this story, there's a point when Maya is in a public bathroom, exactly like Harley was, and she's dying. And she hears the voice of her dead grandfather, her popo, who calls her, "Breathe, Maya, breathe." And she sees his shoes. So for me, that is one of the gifts of being a writer, that sometimes people tell you details, little stories that can make a book. That story can start a whole book, because you need only that to create the whole world around it. So I'm very blessed. The other day, I was in New York, and I was walking with a friend. And we were just walking in the street. And she was telling me the story of her mother, part of the story of her mother. And it was like those moments when you know that there is something precious there, a gem. I said, "Don't tell me more, because if you tell me more, you will ruin the story. Let me imagine the rest." And on January 8th, because I start all my books on January 8th, I started to write the story of this woman, a love story, because of that moment in the street when she started telling me the story. So if you have a gem, email me. Not many details, just a few sentences.
Good evening. I feel I've encountered your family when I was a teenager in high school in Montreal.
How old I am, my God.
No, how old I am. And when the coup in Chile happened, and I was in a school owned by nuns, and we were all into social justice. And so we felt like it was a little bit a part, I don't know why, but in Quebec in general, part of our country, when this happened, it really changed me when also I was in law school and I read your first book in French. And ever since I followed that, your books come like waves, you know, on the ocean, and they come and then they have all those gifts and
thank
beauty.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you for reading them.
And I have a question, and I was wondering which of your book may have brought, it's kind of probably hard for you to answer that, but if there's a book in particular that brought a lot of transformation for you.
You know, every book is a journey into memory. Mm-hmm. Where do you draw the material for a book? Your own experience, your memory, the things you've heard, the things that, the obsessions, the demons, the angels that accompany us in our journey. So I think that in the process of these 30 years of writing, I have slowly found who I am. And I didn't know before. I started writing when I was almost 40. And I had been stumbling from one job to another, one thing to another. At that time, I was living in exile in Venezuela as a political refugee after the military coup in Chile. And I felt that my life didn't have any meaning. It wasn't going anywhere. That everything was so mediocre, so banal in many ways. And then when I started writing, my first book was a crazy attempt to recover everything I had lost. My country, my family, my home, my job, my everything. I realize now that it was a journey into memory. The trying to recover the loss is trying to recover all the things you remember that you don't want to lose. And all my books, in a way, are an exploration of the same themes that always obsess me. Power, abuse of power, death, love, loyalty, honor. Some very important themes in my life because they marked my life. Violence, of course. And I realized that the person I am is the person I have discovered in the characters of my books. I heard once an author said that the author is in every character. You cannot create a character if you are not the character, if you don't get inside the character, which frightens me a little because I have some characters that are really mean, really mean. I always try to create characters, you know, the tall blonde with long legs. I wish. By page 60, I hate her. She dies by page 60. But the person I am is the person that has been building up block by block in this book, word by word in the books.
Hello. Thank you for coming to Seattle and for sharing your books with us.
Oh, this is a wonderful town, and I come often. Thank you.
Well, we're glad to have
you. And by the way, it has never rained when I'm here. Never.
I think we need you to come more often then. I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about where you look for inspiration and then also your writing process, sort of how you approach writing.
Well, my writing, inspiration is, as I said before, things that I have either experienced or sometimes those gems that fall on my lap, but that's not very often. There's a lot of discipline and study. If I find a thread, a theme, I start researching. And the research gives me 80% of the book. Because you find in the research things you would have never imagined, never. So it's a wonderful source of material. The thing is that you have to study and remember where you found it also. I'm disciplined because this is my job. This is not a hobby. So I get up early and I write most of the day when I'm writing. And I'm writing usually at the beginning of the year. I start all my books on January 8th. Why? Because I started my first book on January 8th. My first book was lucky, so I thought, well, for luck, for Kabbalah, I'll start the second one the same date. It was lucky too. And so the third, the same thing, and now I don't dare change because it will be a flop if I change. But also for discipline, because I have a complicated life. Writing is only part of my life. I also have a foundation. But writing means not only the research and all that, interviews, press, traveling, readers that write to me. Every day there are hundreds of emails, and I answer everything. Because if someone has taken the trouble to get in touch with me, I have to answer. So all that is work, a lot of work. So at the beginning of the year, I lock myself away, and I lock myself in a little hut, the pool house that we have in the back of the garden, where I'm disconnected from the universe. The only people that can reach me are my daughter-in-law, my husband, and the dogs. And I write. That's all I do. By 7 o'clock, my husband calls me, and we have dinner, and that's it. That's my day. It's very boring if you look at it from outside. How can I be sitting down for so many hours, but inside my head there is a universe? So that's my job. And I write directly on a computer. I don't take notes. I can't write by hand. And when I'm traveling, I'm not writing. Only when I'm in that casita, I write.
What an honor it is to meet you. I'm from Chile, and I grew up knowing your books and reading books, your books in school. And I wanted to ask you what it meant for you to finally be recognized in Chile with the National Prize for Literature.
Yeah. In Chile we have a verb, chaquetear. Chaquetear means that you hold someone by the jacket and pull that person down. Let's say that you succeed in anything except soccer. Soccer is the only exception. But if you succeed in whatever, they will pull you down, no matter what. So chaquetear is a part of our national character. If you are a woman, the Chaqueteo is way worse. So The House of the Spirits became a very successful book, and my other books sort of opened a way for me abroad. But in Chile, when The House of the Spirits was published, the book was forbidden by the dictatorship, which meant that everybody was reading it, of course. They made photocopies of the book and everybody was reading it. Best advertising, impossible. And then, as I became successful, the people who controlled the little literary world in Chile, the few critics, the literati, my colleagues who hate me, they never recognized me as a writer while I was getting all this recognition abroad. Finally, things got so obvious in Chile that they gave me the highest national award for literature called Premio Nacional de Literatura, which has the wonderful thing, this prize was created to award writers who are usually very poor so that they could live for the rest of their lives with a pension. So it means a pension for life. So it's a very desired award. Many people said that I didn't deserve it because I could support myself. And then other people said, well, but the award is given for merit, not for poverty. So in any case, I got the award and everything changed for me in Chile. I got the respect and the recognition that I had not had before. So it was really wonderful, really wonderful for me.
Thank you also for your books and the doors that they open into your world. I think I've read most of them. I'm currently finishing Portraits in Sepia. And I know you've talked a little bit.
You are far behind. Far behind. I wrote that like 15 years ago.
I'm all over the place. You talked a little bit about your inspiration, but there's something from that book that will stay with me always, and that's the scene where the wife parades the bed around the town in the beginning because of her husband's lover. And I'm just curious where that story came from.
That happened in San Francisco.
Did it?
I didn't make up that story. So much of that, that's a historical novel. Research. And I found there gems, really. One of them was the bed. That imperial bed that was a replica of the bed of a queen in Hungary or someplace like that. And so that was paraded in the streets of San Francisco. You find the most extraordinary anecdotes. San Francisco is a wonderful city in that sense, full of bandits and prostitutes and awful people. Those are the villains, the people that you really need for literature. Good people, people with common sense. You can't do anything with them. They're useless people.
Hello.
Hi.
Hola. I was wondering if maybe there's a kind of book that you want to write, because you've been writing different kind of stories, or maybe you want to write one specific type
of
book?
Yeah, I do.
What? Which one?
I want to write an erotic novel. Unfortunately, 50 Shades of Grey all day and dirty. But also, my mother is still alive. She's 92. I'm waiting. She's very healthy, unfortunately.
I might not have a question, but I want to say thank you for all your books. I've been in the United States for 14 years now.
From where are you?
I'm from El Salvador.
Ah, yeah.
And I live under political asylum based on sexual orientation myself. I live in a world where Seattle, especially 14 years ago, was difficult to be a Latino. Well, and not necessarily difficult, but, you know, we were not as many. Things are changing, but you kept me grounded. Your books kept me in contact and in touch with my culture.
Thank you.
And I read you in Spanish, and yes, I have issues speaking English, and I still read in English, but you keep me in contact with who I am as a Latino, with my food, Aphrodite,
yeah.
With, you know,
thank you.
Family, and who I am. So I had to beg the library to get in here tonight. Honestly, I called on Sunday and I said, please let me in. And they did it. So thank you very much. I really appreciate you.
Thank you. You know, of course, I'm in touch with a lot of Latinos, Hispanic people from all over Central America, Mexico, from everywhere where I live, and all over the country, really. And often, young people especially say, we don't belong here completely. We want to belong, but we sort of don't. We are different. And we don't belong in our original countries either. If we go there to visit, we don't fit in. Who are we? From where are we? And I always say, you are bicultural, and that is fantastic. You don't belong here, you don't belong, you belong in both places. I feel that I have one foot in Chile and one foot here, that I brought with me a lot of stuff that I will never give up. And I am receiving a lot from this country and from this culture, the good part that I want in my life. So I choose the best. I'm greedy. Why would I compromise for less?
Gracias. Es un placer. Me llamo Juanita, and I just wanted to thank you so much for your literature.
Thank you.
I myself would consider myself bicultural. I was introduced to your writings by my mother, and we two are from El Salvador. So my question for you, I recently graduated from school, and I did a lot of Latin American studies, and one book that you wrote was so powerful to me was Island Beneath the Sea. And it was such a powerful historical piece, and it resonated me. I read it 3 times while I was in school, just because it was so powerful to me, and I shared it with my classrooms.
And it had a lot of sex.
There was, yes. It's such a powerful story. I'm wondering if you could just share your thoughts and your process behind writing that novel and your perspective and why you did it. I love the book. Thank you.
I will answer that question and your question, and then they will kick us out. Island Beneath the Sea, I wasn't planning to write that book. I was planning to write a book about the pirates of the Caribbean. I'll tell you why. Because I had written Zorro years before. Zorro is a character that I love because he's the first action hero, the masked hero who doesn't need special powers. He's just funny, athletic, a womanizer. Just great. I had written about him, and at some point in the novel, I needed to bring him back to California. But the villain needed to get to California before him, and they had both left Spain at the same time. So I needed to stop Zorro somewhere, so I had him kidnapped by the Pirates of the Caribbean, and he ended up in New Orleans for a few months. That gave time to the villain. And then I was fascinated with New Orleans because I went to the city to research for the book. And I said, the pirates were the first really democratic society. And if we had time, I could explain why. But it was a very interesting society. So I wanted to research about that kind of democracy and who they were. So when I was going to write the book, I went back to New Orleans to research more about the pirates. And I realized that all the French flavor of the city and the voodoo and the much of the culture and the music and much of the way the city, the old city, looks came from 10,000 French refugees that fled from Saint-Domingue, a colony, the French colony of Saint-Domingue that is today Haiti, because of the slave revolt. And so I started researching the slave revolt, and it was a much more fascinating story than the Pirates of the Caribbean. So then I ended up writing that book. It took me 4 years of research, and I got so sick that I thought I had stomach cancer. I couldn't lie down. I had to be up all the time because I would throw up. And my husband, who knows me very well, said, when you finish the book, you will get better, because I had all the tests done and there was nothing wrong with me. And the truth is that the research made me physically sick. The research is about the horrible things that we can do to other human beings if we have power and impunity. That is what the military coup did in Chile, what the torturer does to the victim, what the abusive father does to the children or the wife, what the people who are raping women in Congo do. They have total power and total impunity. They are not accountable. And the worst scenario is slavery. I finished the book. And when the book was published, I got approached by abolitionist movements that exist today. Because today, there are more slaves in the world than ever before in history. There are 27 million slaves that they have counted, probably another 27 that have not been counted. And they are not little girls, little prostitute girls in Cambodia only. It's mainly forced labor. People who are real slaves, some of them in chains, and they work for other people, for free. In this country, we have slavery too. And there is a whole market for slaves. So when I realized that, I had stumbled upon something much greater than I ever thought. So I'm glad you read the book. Thank you.
Buenas noches, Isabel. Qué lindo tenerla aquí en Seattle. I think we all know how the coup that you lived affected you and how much it has influenced your writing. So I'm curious to know how you feel about the direction that Chile is going towards after the coup and the direction that actually Latin America is going towards right now, because there's a big movement happening, and if there's hope for countries that are currently going through things that, like the things that happened in Chile. You know, I'm from Honduras, and there was a coup that happened there in 2009. So,
yeah. It's a complicated question. Let me see if I can start from somewhere. How Chile looks today? Chile is a prosperous country compared to any country in Latin America and most countries in the world. It has political and economic and social stability. The worst problem in Chile is that there is a gap, a huge gap, between the few people who have too much and the rest of the population who have not enough and live on credit. So that disparity creates rage and violence. It's a country where young people are politicized. So young students are protesting in the streets for free education, which we had in Chile before. But when we had the coup in 1973, the Chicago Boys stepped in, and they created culture and an economy of pure capitalism in which everything was privatized. So we lost our health care system, and we lost our educational system. So everything became privatized. That meant that if you can't pay, you don't get it. So people live on credit. Chile, many people in the United States, and I've read this in the Washington Post, and this is why it makes me so angry, in the Wall Street Journal, it makes me so angry that people attribute the economic prosperity of Chile to the tough economic rules of the dictatorship, in which there was absolute freedom for money and capital, and the labor force was restricted. If a worker complained, he would disappear. There were no political leaders. There were no political parties. The people had no voice. So it was very easy for the big corporations and the enterprises to prosper, for business to prosper. However, in 1981, during the time of the dictatorship, we had an economic collapse because this bubble of prosperity collapsed, as it had to, because it was basically unfair in many ways, artificial. Then we finally ended the dictatorship, and in 1989, Pinochet retired, and we had our first election. And since then, until 4 years ago, we have had, also for more than 20 years, governments of a coalition of political parties of the center and the left, including the Christian Democrats, but excluding the communists, called the Concertación. And the Concertación has brought reconciliation, sort of reconciliation to the country, prosperity, and democracy, which was shattered by 17 years of dictatorship. 4 years ago, or 3 years ago, we had, for the first time, a conservative government, which has done the best they can. But because it is a conservative government that represents the rich, now all the political forces that were subdued during all that time when we were ruled by the center and the left, now they're protesting in the streets. So the poor guy, Piñera, has to deal with all these people who complain. And it's very hard to manage the country. But Chile is doing very well. And our next president, I'm almost sure, will be again Michelle Bachelet, the first woman president that we have had. Michelle Bachelet is a very interesting case because when she was the candidate, everybody thought she will never be elected. She's a single mother. She is agnostic, not Catholic. She's a socialist. She doesn't even look too good. So, never. Michelle Bachelet was elected, and when she left government, She had 80-something, 84% approval in the votes. Never before in Chile a president has done so well. So now she will be the candidate again, I'm sure, and she will be our next president again. I can't take another question because I have to sign all these books.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.